Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. In just a moment, we'll talk about President Donald Trump's tariffs on corn, soybeans, and pork, and the issues those tariffs are causing Iowa farmers. But first, we'll get an update on Sioux City's Expo Center. Officials involved in that Sioux City Expo Center project say the venue could bring tourism and business dollars to the region, and they're encouraging the county to stay committed to the effort. Woodbury County officials talked last week about reconsidering their financial support to the $12 million venue that could bring farm and trade shows to the area. Marty Doherty, the director of Sioux City Economic Development, told Woodbury County officials yesterday how the planned Expo Center has evolved in scope and size and how it could bring more people to the area. Doherty says the 100,000-square-foot venue could help the region compete with large nearby out-of-state cities.
We need more people to move to Iowa, and we need more skilled workers and families and young professionals, and these are the kinds of things that they want.
Doherty adds it's an effort to grow the community and to bring young people to Iowa. Woodbury County Supervisors Chair Rocky DeWitt said he feels like Sioux City has already clarified what that final project will look like, and it's undecided if the county will reduce any of its $1.5 million contribution. DeWitt says he's not sure what the county will do going forward.
The project looks a little more solid, and at least the county board now has an idea of what the final project is probably going to look like and the uses for it. So I feel better about that.
Construction on the Expo Center is slated to start in summer of next year. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. In March, President Donald Trump announced new tariffs on several American commodities to try and gain more favorable trading relations with China. One of them was steel, which caused some concern in the industrial and construction worlds. However, tariffs on commodities like corn, soybeans, and pork have started to hit Iowa farmers where they live, and they're very concerned about that, despite a promise from President Trump last week that he would provide a $12 billion bailout to help with any pain farmers are feeling.
The farmers will be the biggest beneficiary. Watch. We're opening up markets. You watch what's going to happen. Just be a little patient.
However, many Midwest lawmakers, like Republican U.S. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, says patience is not what's needed, and neither is the $12 billion bailout.
Give me trade, not aid. You know, we've spent decades developing these markets. Let us have access to them. End the trade war now.
Iowa soybean farmers have been echoing the same sentiments lately. Chuck White is a soybean farmer in Spencer, and he's also a regional executive director for the Iowa Soybean Association. White says he's been talking to farmers in northwest Iowa about the effects of tariffs on their bottom line.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern, I'll tell you. There's people that are financially being impacted by the tariffs in the United States, especially any farmer that has any kind of cash rent or mortgage to pay. Those people are being impacted heavily because of the tariff. It's cutting into our bottom line with soybean prices at a 10-year low. It definitely impacts a lot of Iowa producers.
So are some of these folks people that voted for President Trump? I'm assuming they are.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of folks out there that I know voted for President Trump, and now are just a little bit concerned that this is cutting into, you know, our financial situation. With the tariffs in place, it's got the profitability of soybeans that they're not profitable anymore. We're at a loss, and that's not a situation that we can survive for very long. So we're still confident and hopeful that there'll be something resolved. If it's not, I know that the administration has offered $12 billion of additional support for farmers this year, and that's not what we want. We want trade. And with Iowa Soybean Association, especially working for 35 years with China and establishing a market there, and now to have it basically gone away, it's not a good situation for us. But not to say that the rest of the world isn't in here buying some soybeans also. It's taken some of that production from South America, shifted it over to the Chinese, and then we've got other people from around the world that are now coming in to buy soybeans from the United States. You know, before the 25% tariff went on, we had some purchases from China and also from other buyers from Europe and other countries around the world, Egypt, Pakistan, Indonesia. They bought, you know, several million bushels of soybeans, and even we had a 9 million bushel purchase from Argentina, the largest in 20 years since they had a drought this year. So we're still going to use soybeans in the world. It's just going to be maybe in different places, but it has impacted our profit in farm country, that's for sure.
Could it shut some farmers down?
I don't know if we can say that for sure, but it's not going to look good on their balance sheet. So I know that when you take the value of your crop and cut it by at least two bushels, or $2 per bushel, and you add that to your bottom line, it reduces your bottom line by, I'll just use a simple number of 60 bushels an acre. You know, it's $120, and that's a substantial loss to soybean farmers.
Has anyone there talked to Congressman Steve King about this? Has he said anything about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a meeting in Spencer just last a week ago, Friday, I believe it was, and we expressed our concerns to Congressman King, and he said he'd take our concerns right back to the president and explain to him what our concerns are, that you know, a lot of Iowa supported him and got him elected, and we're sure counting on having our trade not impaired and impacted by these trade tariffs. So we're hoping that that message will reach Washington and they'll get the negotiations moving forward.
The governor, after last week when the president announced the, you know, the $12 billion in assistance for farmers, she made the comment that, it's nice to have the help, but that's not what farmers want. Farmers want to be able to raise their crops and sell their crops.
Yeah, definitely. We don't want money coming from the government, that's for sure. Because like I said earlier, we worked hard to build these trade relationships, and we've built that relationship for trade, and that's what's built our markets. You know, we were starting to look at the possibility of additional demand around the world for soybean products, and then all of a sudden here we thought we were going to avoid a trade war, but now we're in the middle of it. And I know that it takes time to get work through these things, but we're sure hopeful that they'll get it solved here, you know, pretty soon. I know I had an email here recently from a pretty reliable source that said that the Chinese would like to resume trade negotiations, and they'd like to see it on a less combative approach to the talks. So I don't know what that means, you know, if they're afraid of us or what, but we're not wanting to, ruin our sale of soybeans to a country that has the largest population in the world and needs protein. Those folks need a good diet, and they are getting one because of the soybeans we ship to them, and also a lot of the meat that we also ship overseas. It's a large part of where our soybeans go is into meat production, and they were starting to buy some more of our meat products.
Well, former Governor Branstad's over there.
Yeah, Yeah, we were hoping that he could have some impact, and maybe he has, and we haven't heard a whole lot. I wish we could get some more words and the information from him and find out what he's doing, because I know he has had a good relationship too with the Chinese, and we're hoping that that will continue. So, and again, another quick point is that also the Chinese soybean processors are starting to shut down some of their processing plants due to the loss of U.S. imports, you know, after this 25% tariff was put on. So that means they're starting to lose supply, and I know they need a good supply of soybeans so they can crush them there in China and feed them to their livestock, especially their hog productions. I know some numbers that have been thrown around is that, let me think here. Thailand was around $2.6 billion a year is what the estimate for both the U.S. and China will lose with this trade war going on, and Brazil's going to gain 2.2. So, you know, there's always a winner and a loser, and right now the U.S. and China are both ending up losers on this thing. You know, we don't want to see that happening at all for very length of time at all. So we're going to have to keep working with the administration and make sure that they know that the soybean farmers of the United States, especially Iowa.
You're a farmer as well, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
That's
yeah,
what I thought.
In Northwest Iowa with my brother, Kevin White. And we don't have a large farm, but we definitely have a good amount of production. We're always looking for better ways to improve our productivity on our farm, especially no-till and the use of cover crops and you know, manures to increase the production every year. And that's what all farmers like to strive for, is, of course, to improve production. And for us, our operation, it's been the use of no-till and cover crops, too. And it's a steep learning curve, but it's, I think, for long-term production, that's the way to go.
So how are you holding up under the strain and worry over these prices?
Oh, yeah. It's scary, you know, when you see those bean prices drop to a 10-year low, and you don't know how long that's going to last. And like I said before, we do not want to have any kind of government payments coming to us, because it doesn't do the farmer any good, and it's not good for the public to see that, too, because we're not out here for that. We're out here to make the best market in the world and produce the best, safest world's food supply. And I know that we're all looking forward to doing that, and that's what we're out here to do.
That was Chuck White. He's a regional executive director for the Iowa Soybean Association. White is a corn and soybean farmer in Clay County. While Chuck White has a boots-on-the-ground perspectives of commodities tariffs, Morningside College professor Patrick Bass sees tariffs in an economic, historical, and cultural perspective. Bass is a professor of history and the chair of the Morningside College History Department. Bass says trade tariffs are not serious with only one country, but the overall trade deficit might be more serious if we could actually calculate what he calls the invisibles,
which is insurance, consulting, and other forms of trade, which are not goods. And those are harder to trace and harder to track. If we were to try to estimate that, I doubt if the United States has a trade deficit at all. I suspect it's about even. And in general, the world is about even. Generally speaking, you cannot have enormous trade deficits year after year. The United States is in a special position because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, and oil is denominated in dollars on the international markets. Thus, the United States has a built-in advantage because of that, and thus we can sustain low-interest trade deficits. But on the whole, I think there isn't much of a trade deficit because they're not calculating in these other things that we usually call invisibles. Goods, yes. But that's not the only way to make money these days.
Well, here in Iowa, a lot of farmers are pretty concerned about, you know, their crops, about pork, and also about aluminum. Aluminum is very important in agriculture, as in, you know, industry. How much do you think this is really hurting farmers and hurting the economy so far?
We have to understand that the first way to look at anything like tariffs, which are very complicated issues and go all the way back to the founding of the Republic, tariffs were a key issue even then. Cui bono, who benefits? And how do they benefit? And what is the goal? So I suspect that the real issues here are that if you look at a political map, I think it gets clearer as to why they would put tariffs on steel and aluminum and not care so much if there are tariffs on soybeans and corn. Look at the political map of the election of 2016. Figure out where the key states are. I suspect that those are issues we need to be paying attention to. The farmers are going to go through a period like the 1980s with this. And I don't see any other way around it. The assumptions built in here are that the other sides will blink. I don't see any evidence that China will ever blink. I see little evidence that the EU needs to blink. They may choose to blink for other reasons related to NATO. See, I mean, it's all very complicated. You have to take it in the full picture. You can't isolate it away from everything else. It's also, again, all about tangible interests versus intangible interests. For example, you could smile at me nicely and sincerely, and I would feel good inside, and that's an intangible interest. You could hand me cash. Here's the issue. Who do they have to deliver tangible interests to in order to maintain their support? Which groups will it suffice to deliver only intangible benefits? The issues are also wrapped up with what the other folks are doing or not doing. And we're not paying attention to that. The United States tends to be very insular in its news coverage. And the rest of the world is just not important, you know, in general to most Americans. We don't cover that stuff. Now, the ones that are really going to suffer here, besides our own people, are the Canadians. And of all things, to suggest that Canadian trade is a national security issue is a very interesting stalking horse, because these tariffs were imposed by the president not on the basis of the way tariffs are traditionally imposed, which is by Congress, by vote, but because of national security issues. That also plays a key role here as to what they're doing, why they're doing it, why they're doing it that way. So that's what I'm going to be talking about on Wednesday, August 1st.
When I think of tariffs, really the tariffs I remember from school, from college, is Smoot-Hawley. Learned all about Smoot-Hawley, 1929, went into the Depression. Those tariffs were passed by Congress, and this is something that the president just came out with.
Again, tariffs have been a key issue in politics since the 1780s. They've never gone away, not once, not ever, because they are about three different things that we care about. One is national income. It's one of the ways the government raises money, sources of revenue. The other is protecting certain elements or factions in the national economy by putting the tax up, because a tariff's a tax. It's a tax on American consumers. You put the tariff up high enough and people stop buying foreign goods and will buy domestic goods. Okay, that's the idea of protection. We already have strong protective tariffs. We also have quotas to protect certain industries, have for years. Look at sugar, if you ever really want to see. There's quotas. The issue of trade also, however, is about trying to get the other side to change its behavior. Economic sanctions on North Korea or on Iran are the ultimate use of trade to try to get policy changes abroad. Now, those economic sanctions can take three forms. One is like the total trade difference, you know, just like no trade. We've also tried we're not going to import anything from them, but we'll sell to them. And we've also tried the other way. We're not going to sell to them anymore. That's where the 1980s came in, the Carter wheat embargo on Russia to get it to change its policy in Afghanistan. That didn't work. We've tried embargoes before. That doesn't work. Sanctions are often cited as not working to change behavior. Historically, there's lots of examples of that. Because oftentimes the other country is pursuing something considered dear to their own national interest, and they will accept any amount of penalty economically to secure the national interest. The issue of not buying from them is what is going on now. We are not embargoing them, we're not sanctioning them. This is we are going to ram up tariffs to protect our industries, but mostly to punish them. Unilateral punishment by the United States is based on the assumption that the American market is so important to these people that they will change what they consider to be in their best national interest. I don't know. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. But in the short term, there will be pain, because that's what tariffs do. They raise consumer prices here. And when the other side retaliates, there's also pain, because we lose the export markets, because that's what they're doing. They're punishing us. So it's like two boxers standing in the middle of a ring, throwing haymakers, seeing which one falls first. Well, that's an interesting question. The United States has never been known for its patience. We always talk about, well, what are the next quarterly earnings statements going to be? Where are the polls today? Other places have a longer history of more patience. So we'll see. Again, I'm trying to put this in the broadest perspective of what are the purposes of the tariffs? What are the goals of the other side? Where might there be a meeting ground? But really, in the end, cui bono, who benefits? And why are some things not pursued? Did you note that originally in the tariffs, there were going to be Chinese flat-screen televisions? Those were taken off. Why? Right? So you need to also look at absence as well as presence to try to figure out exactly what's going on here. We only targeted certain goods, not all goods. The issues are tangled and complicated. I'm not going to get in the weeds. I'm not going to get in the weeds about tariffs, because that would take a couple of years of talking. But I'm going to try to paint a broad stroke picture about what is really going on at a really macro level. And in the end, American exporters will be hurt, because when their prices go up because of the tariffs, they have to transfer those prices to their buyers. Their buyers aren't going to buy if they can find it cheaper. And there's nothing that the Americans export that other places don't export as well. And people will be happy to jump into that fight and take the place of the United States here. Moreover, there's domestic producers in Europe that are happy to jump in and take over. Eastern Europe, in particular, is very agricultural, and it's been complaining about imported food for quite a while. What does that mean? Again, do they want our market for their exports enough to sacrifice some of these interests? I don't know.
That was Morningside College Professor of History, Patrick Bass. Bass is also the chair of the school's Department of History. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Brianna Martinez and Alexis Bell have created a new project, Sonder. The first piece of this project uses interviews performed by Laura Lemmy during her year in Sioux City. As Laura talked with many people, proving that everyone has their own stories and journeys that cannot be seen by the naked eye.
My name is Laura Lemmy.
I'm from France.
My name is Mary Day.
Sofia Marrufo.
My name is Joad Sadiki.
Kelly Hendrick. Yoni Landeros.
Mark Leonard.
My name is Ale Lemay.
My name is Susan Leonard.
Where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Sioux City, Iowa.
I grew up not too far from Sioux City on a farm.
I grew up in Venezuela.
Orange City, Iowa, on a farm.
I actually grew up in California. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area originally.
I grew up in Canada, in the province of Quebec, in a small city called Baie-Comeau.
I grew up in Afghanistan. It's a country in the Middle East.
I grew up here in Sioux City.
I grew up in Redfield, South Dakota.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I'm the oldest, and I have a sister, a little brother, and then a truly little brother who's much younger, who lives far away in New Zealand.
I have one sister, and she lives on the farm where I grew up.
Yes, I have an older brother and a younger sister.
Yes, I have two siblings, one little sister, she's 14, and one little brother, he's 10.
I have two brothers.
I'm in the middle, and I have two sisters.
Yes, there were seven of us, and my last name is Day, so we had a week of days.
Do you have children?
Two children. One is you, Laura Lemay, and the other is your brother, Etienne Lemay.
I have two children. I have a daughter named Casey and a son named Sam.
We have two children, an older daughter and a boy about not quite 2 years younger.
I have a daughter. She's 3 years old. Her name is Ariane.
What is your job?
I work in construction, so I have a couple of different jobs. I work in large pre-engineered metal buildings, and I also put lines in parking lots.
I worked at the Family Medicine Residency Program. So young people who had just finished medical school came to this program to do 3 years of training.
At the moment, I work on a construction site in North Sioux City, South Dakota.
My job is that I'm working in Meritrulia. And I'm teaching English to people that doesn't have it as a first language.
I am the general manager of the public radio station in Sioux City.
I am a structural engineer.
I do a lot of volunteer work, but I was a college and vocal music teacher.
I work at a firm and I coach clients how to be their own bankers.
Do you travel a lot?
We traveled. We lived in South Korea for a year. And then we lived in Chicago for a while.
I haven't traveled as much as I would like to, but I've traveled to the West Coast a lot, and I used to live out there.
I travel once in a while for my work. At the moment, we traveled here at North Sioux City as a family.
I do travel a lot. I love to visit a lot of cities, and 50 cities are on my bucket list in the United States.
Well, I travel far. I guess, yes, I like to travel, and I've been in a lot of countries in South America and a couple of states here in America.
Do you know another language?
No, regrettably, I don't. I barely know English.
I have studied Italian and French and German.
The English language that I'm speaking right now is not my mother tongue, so I can speak English fluently. I speak Turkish, I speak Persian, Pashto, I speak Hindi, the Indian language.
I know how to speak French, speak write and read, and also German.
I know Spanish.
I don't. I speak only English.
It's Susan Leonard, and I'm here with Laura and Delphine. They want to say goodbye.
Goodbye, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Sonder is a project that emphasizes that no one is an extra in another person's life. It is produced by Brianna Martinez and Alexis Bell, who encourage others to tell their own stories and to listen to the stories of others. Thank you. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. An event this weekend invites the community to experience Africa through food, fashion, music, and more. Our arts producer, Allie Carson, has this story about the annual festival and what it means to local African-born families like the Okines.
Because they were born here. There's a lot they don't know about Ghana. And we needed to point them to their roots and encourage them that there is hope at the light of the tunnel.
They found a home for their fellowship at the First United Methodist Church in Sioux City.
So we came together and decided that we're going to have a summer classes with them. So we met every Friday. All the families came together with the parents and we'll meet and take a character in the Bible, talk about it, help the children to understand. Then we tell them how it relates to our story. Now, every parent told their story, the difficulties we've gone through before we got here. So the children appreciated it. And the children asked a lot of questions so they could identify with us that we are here because of them.
What grew out of that is African Night, an annual festival that celebrates the diversity and culture of African countries, concentrating on the ones represented in Sioux City.
We started the African Night every first Saturday in August, just to be able to tell the children more of the culture, the religion, the traditional dancing, the cuisine, and the rest. And we felt that it will help our hosts, who are Americans, the opportunity to taste our food and know more about Africa. So we decided that it should be a one-stop shop where they can know about the real truth of Africa and how it's developing and some of the challenges. So that's what we did.
Well, I suppose I should ask you a little bit more about the main event of African Night that's on Saturday, August 4 from 2 to 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that you'll be doing, I see that you have a parade of African nations, an exhibition of African artifacts, drumming, dancing, some fashion, and looks like food, too. Mm-hmm.
The Parade of African Nations, for instance, we decided to include it because Africa is a continent and it comprises about
55 nations.
Mm-hmm. That's Derek's wife, Theodora Okine. They came to the United States from Ghana.
And so when we do the Parade of African Nations, we have the flags of each individual country is represented by its flag. And then we walk it over the stage for people to see. So like if it is a flag of Ghana, we have somebody representing that flag so that people can actually see that Africa is not just one country, but it is 55 different countries. Mm-hmm. And we each have our different languages and our different flags and, you know, whatever. So that is actually what the Parade of Nations is about. So we have our crafts. And we have our beads, we have our jewelry, we have our clothing, and the way we dress, the way we put on our jewelry or our beads depicts where we're coming from. And it also goes a long way to talk about us as individuals with our in relation to our ethnicity. So these are things that we display, and then usually we have them like in consigned areas,
and then people can wear and take pictures
standing by it to explain what it all means. And then the fun thing is people can wear the same clothes and take pictures, and it's for them. They just go away with their pictures, which we hope will bring the memory of the event.
Then the display of the various African dishes. We have dishes from usually from Congo, from Benin, from Rwanda, from Burundi, from Ghana, from Nigeria, from various countries, Burkina Faso, and then Ivory Coast. A lot of countries were represented here. So they all bring dishes. They may look the same, but usually the ingredients may be different. And so we try to tell people that some of it can be very hot. Just be careful spicy about the way you spicy. So you
and
don't.
African dishes are quite spicy.
Yeah, so I think
but it's not too spicy for you not to be able to eat it.
Yeah, and we want people to taste all of it.
Yes.
So people will really know that we can relate to some of these things, you know.
Yeah.
For the fashion parade, one thing which I personally, as an African, I'm proud of is when an African dress in traditional, it speaks volumes. We don't just dress. You look at the occasion and the language you want to tell people, then you dress that way. My wife will tell you most of the dresses, they wear the cloth, they speak. They all have names. You know, we have the kente and we have different depictions as to when you come there, you see some of them. And all of them have a language they minister to people. So it's good you ask the Africans, why are you wearing this? What is the occasion? What are you telling me? You know, just like we go to school and we beat drums instead of bell to invite. We do so many things to speak volumes to our children so they can grow in that wealth of knowledge. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so part of this is to, you know, expose the Sioux City community to, you know,
various African
traditions.
Yeah, and culture. As well as to teach your children your customs and culture.
Mm-hmm. Because the children who are born here, sometimes they get lost. In the classroom, the teachers ask them, and because they've not gone back, they can't really tell. So this is a way of educating them, so they'll be proud of where their parents are coming from and what they can learn from it. So it's a lesson for them, you know.
Yeah, and how do you balance that part of, like, assimilating and in one way wanting to belong and be American while also holding on to where you came from and being proud of that?
I would say that it's good to appreciate every small beginning. We try to know that, we are African. We belong to the continent. This is what we are. But here we find ourselves in a new environment. So we try to learn more about the environment, look for the similarities and the differences, and then appreciate both countries. Now, in trying to appreciate, we try to walk along with our children, because our children easily get lost. In Africa, it is never allowed for children to, when you enter a vehicle, a transport, to be sitting whilst adults are standing. But here we see something differently. They go to the bus and they are seated when adults, we don't do that. So we teach them all this, that look, this may be countercultural to our African distinct, but this is who we are. It shows a lot of respect. And we children never speak back to our parents. Now, I have traveled a little and I noticed Asians bow their head. Africans will not bow their head. They look in the eyes, but to show that they appreciate what you are telling them, they will learn from it and be able to make good use of it. So we try to work with our children, always reminding them that this is where you come from. Be proud of it. It may not be the way you want it, but there is a lesson to learn from it, and then you can build on it. So there's always a lot our children learn from it.
And that is not to say that whatever we see here, we just push it aside and tell them that this is wrong. We still make them appreciate what they learn here so that life here will be comfortable for them. But at the same time, we try to incorporate what we know from home so that when they also get home, someday they are not found wanting.
African Night is Saturday, August 4, from 2 to 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Sioux City. Derek O'Kine leaves us with this message.
You can't stand from far and expect to know about Africa. Draw closer. We believe in relationships. Relationships are very important for us. So people should come and relate to us, and that would be a very good thing.
For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Ellie Carson. Thank you.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Robin Hood, the quintessential hero from England, didn't ride the plains, didn't know a buffalo from a paddlefish, yet he is at the heart of how we imagine plains life. Jim Skop brings us to that beginning.
Robin of De Smet. It's a stretch to think of Robin Hood on the Great Plains. The court of warriors could do magic tricks with a bow and arrow, but somehow the hero of Sherwood Forest would be a foreigner in a landscape without trees. The plains just ain't the place for Robin Hood. But let's try. Think of him emerging angel-like from a broad field of 12-foot hybrid corn in yet another field of dreams. Suddenly, there he is in green leotards. Friar Tuck is with him, and Little John and his entire merry band. Still a stretch. Here's the story. Robin of Locksley, our hero, was born in a novel by Sir Walter Scott, an Englishman, a Scot actually, who published dozens of novels in the early decades of the 19th century. That novel, Ivanhoe, did much to make the Middle Ages popular. After all, romantic lore, adventure, love, and war is a can't-miss combo. What I'm suggesting is that once upon a time, Robin of Sherwood was as great a hero in Siouxland as he was in merry old England. Hark! Years ago, a Norwegian bachelor farmer, or someone kin thereof, a man named Old Sheldon, knocked on the door of a distressed young mom. Now think of him as a guardian angel in bibs, a straw hat, maybe a corncob pipe, or a chunk of chaw on his grizzled cheek. His nose is beet red, and when he doffs that hat, he's bald as a buzzard, two handfuls of old man hair sprouting hither and yon. Old Sheldon carries a bag, and when that distressed young mom lets him in, he shuffles by her and dumps out the contents. Now, first, a word about this young mom. Her husband just learned the affliction he's been fighting is not going away. When they were married, he risked life and limb in a bitter cold to save a neighborhood, riding through a blizzard the likes of which we only rarely see. Both hands and feet were frozen. He never regained the strength he once had. They were told not to expect a miracle. What's more, the young mom is pregnant. She already has a little one, is fighting off an awful bout of morning sickness just like the ravages she lived with the first time around. Besides, this pregnancy wasn't convenient, wasn't something she would have chosen because she can't help be worried about how the family is going to eat. The young mom is plain miserable. That's exactly how she described herself the day old Sheldon toted that bag in. She was particularly blue and unhappy. Her words. So, old Sheldon flips that bag and dumps out the contents on the floor of her cabin, an entire collection of Sir Walter Scott's Waverley novels, as popular as Harry Potter back then throughout the English-speaking world. And now this. Chances are that distressed mom is someone you know. Her name was Laura Ingalls Wilder, who would have to get somewhat older before she would, like Sir Walter Scott, write a whole sack full of novels. I don't know that we think enough about guardian angels. How about a nomination for Old Sheldon? When he stuck that straw hat back on his bald head, it likely didn't even cover the halo. Or how about this? There's a pile of Scott novels on the floor of the cabin. Laura Wilder forgets her morning sickness because out of the cracks between those old books, a cover or two or three open mysteriously so that, in camo leotards and a goofy little hat, this skinny medieval archer becomes the Jolly Green Giant. Quiver full of arrows up on his back for that bow he's got over his shoulder. It's Robin of Sherwood Forest. You bet it is. Robin of Locksley, a guardian angel right here on the plains, a hero. For Laura Ingalls Wilder, a turning point. Just what the doctor ordered.
Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Mary Hartnett.